Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Growing up, I was introduced to a topic called Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs. You've probably heard of this before. It has its critiques, and I'm not here to get into that. But I wanted to bring this up because today's episode focuses on that base level of what a human needs to survive, right? There are things like water and food and sleep, air, clothing, and shelter. If you like human beings, then you should probably believe that shelter is a basic human right. And yet it is one that in our capitalist societies, we do not supply or view as a right. For that reason, there are so many people who are homeless, and homes are viewed as a investment strategy or a way to make other people money. We see that through vast rent infrastructure. We see that in massive corporations buying out homes and driving up prices. And we see that in people being more and more outpriced of home ownership. There are plenty of valid arguments for and against home ownership. It's not the right choice for everybody. Many people would prefer to rent. Today, I want to focus on some of the pressures that are happening in the housing world, some recent developments based on the economy, some trends that we're seeing with housing that I think are very indicative of the economy that we're living in and the world that we're heading towards. The first thing that I want to mention is just this new stat that was announced, essentially saying that home foreclosures surged 38% in the last year, and then claiming that the U.S. housing market is on the brink. Experts warn the housing bubble is about to burst as the U.S. economy is now running on fumes. This is coming from a Substack by someone named Chris Jeffries. As far as the claims that it's making about the overall state of the economy and what this means, this is a Substack. So much of this is going to be conjecture and things like that. But the stat itself comes from verifiable sources showing that these foreclosures are on the rise. Now, this doesn't necessarily show us what the pressures are that are causing it, but it does show that there are increasing pressures on those owning homes. Now, some of those pressures are coming from within the homeownership model itself, and some of those pressures are coming from other economic factors. If I lose my job, I cannot afford my home. That is a given. Today, we're not going to focus so much on those external pressures. I want to talk about the internal pressures. What is it that's happening within home ownership that is making home ownership more difficult? So one example of this is a rise in the number of micro apartments, tiny apartments smaller than 400 square feet that are taking over American cities. Some people hail these as, you know, the ability to give somebody a start, right? It's a minimalist approach. The problem is when these do not end up costing that much less than traditional housing. Because there is a housing shortage, that housing shortage is one of those pressures I am referring to here. It means that people will pay more to get into any home. And while, yes, this home is smaller or this apartment is smaller, even though it may be a third the size or a fifth the size of another home, does not mean that it's going to cost a third as much or a fifth as much because these are in higher demand. If you have a large number of people who have been priced out of traditional homes or apartments searching for these smaller micro apartments, that is itself driving up the demand and driving up the cost. So you may be paying barely less for a 400 square foot apartment than you would for an 800 square foot apartment. And in some cases, depending on where you are, what city or the cost of living, you may be paying much more for a 350 square foot apartment than you would for a 1200 square foot apartment somewhere else. There's a YouTube video on this trend that I will share in the episode description. It takes a very interesting look. And one of the things that it looks at is this idea that housing is sort of like shrinkflation. There's this idea, and the one that it compares to is Pringles cans, saying that the size of Pringles cans is shrinking. There are less chips inside, and yet the price is staying the same or increasing. So not only do we experience inflation in that manner, we experience shrinkflation. And housing is doing much of the same. The size or quality, longevity, location, of our homes are getting smaller, but the average cost may be staying the same or increasing even at those smaller sizes. Begs the question of whether or not this is the future of housing. Are we heading into a world where we're going to have millions and millions of micro apartments crammed into skyscrapers in which people are sleeping in the same room that they're eating and are lucky to have a partition or a wall separating the toilet from the rest of the living space? Now, I know this is still much better living than many places in the world that don't have access to, you know, modern construction. I've mentioned before that I spent years outside of the U.S., primarily in South American countries like Peru and Colombia. And while many people live great in those places, there are so many areas which are, you know, shacks. I think the point I'm trying to get at with this portion of the episode is simply that the trend in the U.S. for the size of homes that people can afford is getting smaller and smaller. And this brings up an interesting question. As we talk about sustainability for consumption and, you know, environmental stability, these types of things might be the right direction to head. Instead of people living in mansions, if everyone agreed to consume less and live in smaller spaces, I don't know if 350 square feet is the right number, but that it could be better in the long run. But the main purpose of talking about this is not to talk about whether or not this is good for consumption. It's more about how people are being priced out of, you know, what used to be the American dream, where a father working an average job could provide for his family of five, have a car in the suburbs on a half acre lot, you know, with a 2,000 square foot house or whatever. That's the way it used to be. And today we're talking about having to try and squeeze inside of a 350 square foot house just to get by and paying relatively the same amount. This might be what the average person can afford. Talked recently, just a few days ago, about the homeless using RVs and how there's this sort of van lords, people who are taking old broken down RVs and vans and renting them out. I think I might have mentioned this, I don't remember, but I dream of being able to get a small compact van to travel in. I think it would be amazing to be able to travel around the continent, exploring new places, sleeping in and living out of a van. But I would not want ever to be forced to live full time in a old, broken, stationary, rundown van. There's sort of this stereotype or cliche, I guess, around trailers and trailer parks. And that used to be that sort of lower bound of what a temporary living situation might be like, right? Or a not so optimal place to live. And now we're taking a step further into having to rent, still for probably way too much money, an old broken down vehicle to live in that probably doesn't supply the heat and energy needs and things to meet Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, another interesting aspect to all of this, things that are being proposed as solutions to the housing problems that in reality are going to cause more pain. First, the Trump administration announced a couple of months back they wanted to look into 50-year mortgages. And some people might applaud this and say, hey, this is wonderful. It means lower monthly payments, meaning I can afford more home or afford a home. It just is going to take me a little while longer to pay off. 50 years is insane, first of all. You know, if you purchased a house at 30 on a 50-year mortgage, you're not going to stop paying for it until you are 80 in a future in which we're looking like we're not going to even have Social Security. Terrible idea. Not only that, you think about the interest impacts. Just for some percentage ideas here, right? I'm going to use a 7% interest rate that seems like a pretty fair average over the last 30 to 40 years for interest rates. My home that I purchased at the end of 2024 was on a 7% interest rate. On a normal 30-year mortgage, for every $100,000 of house that you buy, you will pay $139,600 in interest, meaning that over the course of those 30 years, 58% of all of your money that you paid towards your home went towards interest. If you're able to do a 15-year mortgage, that number goes down from 58% to 38%. And that is a massive difference. For every $100,000 that you purchase in home, you will only pay $61,800 in interest. On a 50-year loan, you are now looking at paying $285,800 in interest. 74% of what you paid goes to interest, meaning three times as much of your money would go to interest over that time period than the principal of your home. Now, putting this into more realistic numbers as far as what an average home might cost, if you paid $400,000 for a home, which these days that is below the median home cost in the United States, on a 15-year loan, you would pay $647,000. So you paid $400,000 for the house and $247,000 in interest. That's painful, but it is what it is. That's on a 15-year loan, which most people are not able to afford that type of payment. On a 30-year loan, the total amount that you will have paid is $958,000, meaning you paid $400,000 for the principal and $558,000 additional in interest. Now we look at a 50-year loan. You will have paid over those 50 years $1.54 million, which means that you paid $400,000 for the principal and $1.14 million in interest. You want to hear the most cruel part about all of this? If you look at the monthly payments, the 30-year loan was a $2,661 payment. The 50-year loan was a $2,572 payment. That's a $90 difference per month payment. So for like $100 a month, you can pay an extra, $700,000 almost in interest over 50 years. It's just an unbelievably terrible idea. And inevitably, when people need to sell their home earlier, they only live in the house for 3 years or 5 years and sell, they will have no equity in it. They will not have put in enough money to cover it. And if the market goes down at all, you suddenly have a ton of people that are underwater. It's just, from an economic standpoint, would be terrible. Now, Trump did put a pause on the 50-year mortgage plan. They said, you know what, actually, we've got some other priorities. We're going to work on some other stuff. But he didn't stop there. He said, we're going to do some other things that we still believe will help and maybe even be more helpful, which is we're going to prepare an executive order that allows for people to use funds from their 401k or 529 accounts for down payments penalty-free. So let's say you've been working for 10 years, you're 35 years old, 10 years in your career, you've been diligently putting money into your 401k for retirement, and the government's saying, if you want a house, you're going to have to pull from your 401k to pay for it. And it's going to be ever tempting to do that. We're going to let you. Yeah, you know what? You've got $50,000 in your 401k or $60,000 in there. No problem. No penalty. Just put it towards a home. It's worth it. And now you have people sacrificing their future in order to live in a 450 square foot house in an apartment building 60 floors up. Those early years of 401k investment are the absolute most important. They are the ones that are going to add up because of the power of compounding interest over the next 50 years or 40 years to allow somebody to retire with a significant amount of money. So that sacrifice, that losing that 401k, is a massive hit for anyone who has sacrificed to invest in it. All right, I'll stop here for now. These are just a few examples of the trends and the direction that we're headed and the pressures that it's putting on people to own homes. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, for plenty of people, renting makes more sense. It is more flexible. It can be more cost-effective in that you don't have to worry about maintenance on the home and all those types of things. It can also be scarier, right? You can be kicked out at any time. You have no control over the cost of your rent and how that may increase over time. You aren't able to make the types of changes to your home that you would like to make, et cetera, et cetera. Becoming a more perhaps difficult decision to make over time, but I guess at the same time, you could say it's becoming easier to make because for many people, home ownership may simply not be an option and renting becomes the only option. However, still at an increasing rate as rent so often keeps with home values and mortgage rates. Happy to hear your thoughts. Feel free to reach out to me. Let me know of any experiences you've had as you attempt to save up for a home, or if you're already in a home, or if you're renting. What other things have you noticed as far as these pressures go? All right, we'll see you. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them.
Thanks.